Welcome to the History Maps podcast. We are stepping right into the searing heat of a South Indian summer. This is in the year 1311.
Right, and it is a deeply volatile situation.
Exactly. You have an army of thousands on the march, and they are commanded by a royal prince who is, well, he is just desperate to secure his throne.
He really is. He's gathered every foot soldier, every cavalryman he can possibly muster, and he's trying to intercept this terrifying new enemy that's moving down from the north.
Right. And his entire strategy hinges on the Kaveri River. I mean, it's this massive, life-giving artery that cuts right across the peninsula. His plan is to march his men along its banks, you know, keeping them hydrated, keeping them moving fast.
Which is standard military logic for the time.
Yeah, but when the prince and his army finally reach the river, they do not find Russian water. They just find cracked mud. The river is completely dry.
It's a logistical nightmare.
A complete nightmare. And that single geographical fluke, you know, that one dry riverbed, it doesn't just cost this prince a single battle. It actually brings about the catastrophic collapse of a polity that had survived and reigned for nearly 2,000 years.
It is arguably one of the most dramatic turning points in the history of the subcontinent. So today, we are taking a deep dive into the sources to really understand the people who marched into that dry riverbed. We are talking about the Pandya dynasty.
The Pandyas. They were one of the three crown kings of ancient Malakkam. Right. So they are sharing this geopolitical stage with the Cholas and the Cheras.
Exactly. But the Pandyas really stand out because they are considered one of the longest ruling dynasties in world history. Mm. I mean, we are looking at a continuous footprint of influence that stretches from roughly 400 BCE all the way to 1618.
Which is just a staggering chronological sweep. It's difficult to fully grasp that amount of time. So to cover it, we are pulling from a massive stack of sources today.
We really are.
We are going to examine classical Greco-Roman texts, Chinese travelogues, the rock edicts of the Maurya Emperor Ashoka. Plus, you know, we have ancient Tamil Sangam literature, epigraphic copper plates, and even hoards of buried coins.
And our mission in this deep dive is to take all of this very diverse material and trace the journey of the Pandyas. We want to follow them from their early origins as ancient pearl divers and, you know, self-proclaimed lunar kings.
Right.
Up through this golden age of absolute imperial conquest. And then right up to that dramatic, tragic collapse that we mentioned, which was fueled by sibling rivalry and a failed monsoon.
Yeah, because piecing together a history this vast, it really requires treating these very different sources as like pieces of a single massive puzzle. You have a Greek merchant's handbook from the first century sitting right next to an 8th century copper plate that was dug up from a temple foundation.
Yeah, and when you synthesize them, the picture that emerges is of a dynasty defined by just ruthless adaptability. They survived for millennia because they fundamentally understood how to reinvent their military and economic systems in response to, well, the shifting winds of Indian Ocean trade and the highly volatile rivalries of the peninsula.
I want to start right at the foundation, long before they were building massive empires. Because if you are going to rule for 2,000 years, you need an ironclad justification for why you, and literally no one else, deserve to sit on the throne.
You need a mandate.
Exactly. We need to look at how the Pandyas projected their power right out of the gate, using linguistics and mythology. Let's look at the name itself. The sources indicate the etymology of the word Pandya likely traces back to the Tamil root Pandi, and Pandi translates to bull.
Right, and in the context of ancient Tamil society, the bull is the ultimate agrarian and martial symbol. You have to consider what an uncastrated bull represents to a pastoral or farming community.
Right.
Completely. It is raw, unpredictable, immense physical power. It represents fertility. It represents virility. So when a ruling family formally adopts the name of the bull, they are encoding a message of dominance into the daily vocabulary of their subjects.
That makes a lot of sense.
Every single time someone speaks the name of the king, they are actively invoking an ideal of unyielding martial strength. But there is also a second linguistic theory we need to note from the sources. Some scholars link the name to the Tamil word Pandu, which translates to old.
Oh, I see. So it is a way of saying we have always been here.
Exactly. It establishes them as the primordial indigenous rulers of the land. It directly counters any narrative that they might be usurpers or newcomers to the region.
But they didn't just stop at linguistics. The sources show they constructed this incredibly elaborate origin myth. The dynasty formally claimed descent from the Chandravamsa, the lunar dynasty.
Which is a massive claim.
Yeah, it means they traced their literal bloodline back to Chandra, the moon god, and then through Buddha. which in this specific context is the personification of the planet Mercury and down to a legendary figure named Puravas.
This is a highly calculated piece of statecraft. To understand why they did this, you really need to understand the broader cultural shift happening across the subcontinent at the time.
Right.
As the Vedic traditions, you know, the ancient religious and cultural frameworks originating in northern India, as those began to deeply influence the South, political legitimacy required a connection to those grand narratives.
So they needed to plug into that established system.
Precisely. The epic texts, like the Mahabharata, they are heavily structured around these celestial lineages, specifically the solar and lunar dynasties. So by claiming descent from the moon, the southern Pandya rulers were inserting themselves directly into the pan-Indian mythological mainframe.
It is essentially the ultimate political branding exercise. You are claiming direct descent from celestial bodies to legitimize your absolute right to rule. And we actually have hard evidence of them promoting this exact narrative, right? The sources highlight something called the Velvakuti Grant.
Yes, the Velvakuti Grant. This is a prime example of an epigraphic copper plate. These were essentially legal documents, and they were inscribed onto these heavy plates of copper and bound with a royal seal.
What were they used for?
Usually detailing a grant of land or resources to a temple or a group of scholars. And because they are copper, they survive in the archaeological record much better than palm leaves or cloth would.
Obviously.
The Velvakuti Grant was actually issued much later, roughly between 769 and 770. But it explicitly outlines this ancient lunar lineage. It even credits that mythical ancestor, Puravas, with bestowing the dynasty with its most famous visual symbol.
The twin fish emblem. Yeah. I want to bring in the international sources here for a second, because seeing how outsiders viewed the Pandyas is really fascinating. Around 300 BCE, you have Megasthenes. He was the Greek ambassador to the Mauryan court in northern India.
Right, highly influential writer.
And he wrote about a southern kingdom he called Panday. But Megasthenes claimed this kingdom was ruled by a daughter of the Greek hero Heracles. Meanwhile, the local Indian legends speak of a king named Maladwajapandiya and his queen, who had a warrior daughter named Meenakshi, or Sathagai. And she is the figure the massive Madurai temple is named after. So why is a Greek ambassador talking about Heracles in the South India?
It's a classic example of Hellenistic syncretism.
Okay, what does that mean in this context?
Well, when Greek writers encountered foreign cultures, they almost always tried to map their own pantheon onto the local gods and heroes, is just how they made sense of the world.
Ah, so they filtered it through their own lens.
Exactly. Megasthenes likely heard tales of this powerful southern kingdom with a formidable female deity or a legendary warrior queen, like the Meenakshi figure. In his mind, the only equivalent to that kind of martial strength was Heracles.
That's interesting.
But the key takeaway for you, as the listener, is the sheer reach of the Pandya reputation. Even in 300 BCE, sitting hundreds of miles away in a northern court, foreign diplomats knew that the Deep South was firmly controlled by this entity known as the Pandyas.
Let's move from the myths into the earliest historical records of their actual operations. We are entering the Sangam period. This spans roughly from the 3rd century BCE to the 3rd century. Their geographic footprint during this time was expansive.
Very expansive.
The early kingdom stretched between Travancore in the west, the Velaru River in the north, and all the way to the ocean in the east and south. But their first capital was not the great inland city of Madurai that we usually associate with them. It was actually a coastal port called Korkai.
And starting at Korkai is the key to understanding their fundamental nature. They were an ocean-facing polity before they were a territorial empire. The sea was their primary frontier.
Right.
But as they accumulated resources from the coast, their ambitions naturally shifted inland. The sources document the reign of an early king named Nidjeljan I. His major military achievement was invading an inland settlement called Kudal.
Which would become very important.
Extremely. He defeated an independent local chieftain named Akutai, took the settlement, and moved his capital there, officially renaming it Madurai.
He also repelled a massive invading army from the Deccan Plateau to the north. The sources note he earned a title that translates to the Pandya who conquered the Aryan army, and his successors did not slow down at all. You have Puttapandiyan, who is noted in the sources as being a poet himself, and then a later king, Nedunjeljan II.
Wait, they kept pushing.
He pushed the borders completely across the peninsula to the western coast. He claimed titles that translate to the king whose lands are washed by two seas.
That aggressive expansion sets the stage for the defining military conflict of this early era, which is the Battle of Talayalanganam. This took place under a king named Nerangelion III.
The geopolitical situation had basically reached a boiling point.
Exactly. The Pandyas were simply growing too powerful. They were disrupting the balance of power in Tamilakam. In response, a massive, unprecedented coalition formed against them. It included their two main dynastic rivals, the Cholas and the Cheras.
And they didn't stop there.
No, they allied with five independent chieftains known as the Valir. Their explicit, documented goal was to partition the Pandy kingdom and erase it from the map entirely.
The sources say Nerangelion III completely routed them, defeating all seven combined armies at once. I have to push back here, though. We are reading texts that were literally commissioned and paid for by the Pandya kings.
That is a very valid point.
Is this idea of one king defeating a seven-army coalition actual historical fact supported by archaeology? Or is this just poetic exaggeration designed to keep the king happy?
That is a very necessary question. You have to understand the mechanics of Sangam literature. The poetry from this era is generally divided into two main genres. You have Akam, which deals with the inner life and romantic love, and Puram, which deals with the outer life.
So war and statecraft.
Exactly. Specifically war, public life, and administration. The Puram poets were heavily patronized by the state. Their job was to glorify the sovereign. So when they describe Nerangelion III single-handedly slaying thousands of men, we absolutely have to filter out the hyperbole.
Right. It is state-sponsored propaganda.
It is. However, we cannot dismiss the core event, because we have external physical validation. There are Tamil Brahmi inscriptions carved into cave beds from this exact period.
Like the ones at Mangalam.
Yes, precisely like those found at Mangalam. And they confirm the existence of these specific kings, their administrative titles, and their territorial reach. If this grand coalition of Cholas, Cheras, and Valirs had actually won at Talayalanganam, the Pandya borders would have immediately collapsed.
We would see a huge shift in the evidence.
Right. We would see a severe contraction in the archaeological footprint of Madurai. We would see their coinage disappear and be replaced by Chola or Chera issues. Instead, the material culture following this period shows continued, explosive expansion and prosperity. So the poetry exaggerates the king's physical prowess, but the geopolitical reality of a massive Pandya victory is archaeologically sound.
Now, to fund that kind of military survival, you know, to build an army capable of breaking a seven-state coalition, that requires an immense amount of capital. And the Pandyas did not find that capital by taxing dirt. They found it at the bottom of the ocean.
Yes, they did.
This brings us to the true economic engine of the ancient Pandya state. We are talking about the global pearl trade. Hmm. The Gulf of Mannar, which sat right off their coast, was the world's leading source of high-quality pearls.
We need to be very clear about the mechanics of this industry. The pearl monopoly was the absolute bedrock of their state power. But the actual physical labor of harvesting these pearls was done by a specific coastal community known as the Paratavar. And this was an unimaginably brutal and dangerous profession.
Walk us through what that actually looked like on a given day.
Well, these divers were operating without any breathing apparatus whatsoever. They would sail out into the Gulf, tie heavy stones to their feet to rapidly drag themselves down to the seabed, and then frantically harvest oysters by hand.
It's just on one breath.
Entirely on a single held breath.
Yeah.
They are dealing with crushing water pressure, complete darkness, the physical exhaustion of constantly surfacing, and of course, the ever-present threat of marine predators.
Right, and the sources specifically mention that threat. They detail the use of specialized shark charmers. These charmers were given a 1/20th share of the entire daily pearl catch just to magically protect the divers from shark attacks.
Which tells you everything you need to know about the psychology and the economics of the trade.
It's like a mob shakedown.
It really is. That 1/20th share was essentially a massive insurance premium. Giving away 5% of the highest value luxury commodity in the ancient world to a mystic proves how pervasive and paralyzing the fear of shark attacks was among the Paratavar. The state allowed this because they desperately needed the divers back in the water the next day.
And the market for what they were pulling out of the water was truly global. The Roman Empire was their biggest customer. We have Roman historians like Pliny the Elder writing about it. We also have a source called the Periplus of the Erythraean Sea. What exactly is that document and what does it tell us?
The Periplus is essentially a first century navigation manual. It's a merchant's handbook written by an anonymous Greek-speaking sailor from Egypt. It details the ports, the navigational routes, and the specific imports and exports of the entire Indian Ocean network.
So it's a primary source on the trade routes.
Exactly. And both the Periplus and Pliny specifically single out the Pandya port of Korkai. Pliny actually complains bitterly about the massive drain of Roman wealth flowing into India to pay for these luxuries.
Because the trade imbalance was staggering. The Pandyas are exporting these pearls, along with spices, ivory, and incredibly fine cotton textiles. And in return, they are importing glass, wine, and literal boatloads of Roman aurei, the gold coins.
Right.
But the sources point out one specific import that was strategically vital for their military, Arabian and Persian horses. Centuries later, the Venetian traveler Marco Polo visited the region and noted that the king spent immense fortunes purely on importing these horses. Why couldn't the Pandyas just breed their own cavalry?
It comes down to climate and diet. The tropical, humid climate of southern India, combined with the lack of specific grasses found in the steppes or the Middle East, meant that imported war horses simply did not survive long.
Oh, so they just kept dying.
Right, nor could they breed effectively. They would sicken, they would weaken, and they would die. But you cannot fight a war against the Cholas without heavy cavalry. So the Pandyas were locked into an endless cycle.
They were trapped.
Completely. They had to constantly pull pearls out of the ocean to buy gold from Rome, to buy horses from Arabia, just to maintain their military deterrence.
And to manage an international supply chain like that, you need a highly functional currency. The archaeological hoards show a clear evolution here. Early on, the Pandyas used simple punch-marked silver pieces. But as this global trade exploded, they transitioned to highly sophisticated die-struck copper coins.
Which is a huge development.
Yeah. These coins featured the dynastic twinfish emblem, along with elephants and bulls.
Standardizing the currency was a massive administrative leap. Because when you strike a coin with the royal seal, the state is guaranteeing its weight and value. This facilitates rapid, large-scale transactions at the ports.
You don't have to test every single coin.
Exactly. A Roman merchant doesn't have to weigh every single piece of silver. They can trust the die-struck coin. Furthermore, it allows the Pandya state to tax the trade efficiently. They control the mint, so they control the economy.
But look at the structure of this economy. If their entire military expansion relies on importing foreign horses, and buying those horses relies entirely on selling luxury pearls to Rome, doesn't that make the entire Pandya Empire dangerously fragile?
Makes it incredibly vulnerable.
You are completely at the mercy of foreign markets. What happens when Rome falls into civil war or the trade winds shift?
You have identified the exact fatal flaw in their system. An export-heavy ancient economy is basically a house of cards. In the 3rd century, the Roman Empire entered a massive period of instability known as the Crisis of the 3rd century.
Right.
They had constant civil wars, plague, and economic collapse. The Roman demand for luxury goods plummeted, so the influx of gold into southern India completely dried up.
Yeah.
And if you cannot sell your girls, you cannot buy your horses.
And without horses, you have no army.
Exactly. This global economic contraction coincides almost perfectly with a period of severe political collapse in Temelocum.
Which leads us directly into what historians call the Calabra Interregnum, or the Dark Age. Despite all that wealth, the early Pandyas are wiped off the map by a mysterious invasion. Who were the Calabras, and why is this period considered a Dark Age?
The Calabras are one of the great enigmas of South Asian history. We know they invaded the Tamil country in the 3rd century and completely displaced the traditional three crowned kings, the Pandyas, the Cholas, and the Cheras.
But why a Dark Age?
We call it a Dark Age not because the people forgot how to read or write, but because the historical records produced by the state almost entirely vanish. The Calabras disrupted the traditional patronage systems. Instead of funding the Vedic temples and the Hindu scholars who typically wrote the history, the Calabras heavily favored Jainism and Buddhism.
Ah, so the people writing the history lost their funding.
Exactly. The traditional chroniclers were silenced, which leaves a massive gap in our sources.
But the Pandyas did not go extinct. Around the year 590, a Pandey king named Kadungan emerges from the shadows. He pushes the Calabras out of Madurai, and this initiates what is classified as the first Pandyan Empire.
Yes, and Kadungan's victory was deeply framed as a restoration of the proper cosmic order. He brought back the traditional Vedic and Shaivite political structures, restoring the temples and the scholars to prominence.
Which got the historical records flowing again.
Right. And following Kadungan, the dynasty undergoes a massive military revitalization. In the 7th century, a king named Erikasari Mauravarman, also known in the sources as Khun Kanyan, leads a series of crushing campaigns. He decisively defeats the Pallava dynasty to the north, who were a major rising power, and crushes the Cheras to the west.
And they realize they need to project power beyond the mainland to secure the sea lanes, right? Later on, a ruler named Sirmara Svarvalabha actually launches a naval invasion. He crosses the ocean and sacks Anuradhapura, which was the glittering capital of Sri Lanka at the time.
It was a huge display of maritime strength.
But this first empire phase has an expiration date. By the 9th century, the Chola Empire rises to a level of dominance that the South had never seen before. The Chola armies, commanded by a general named Aditya Karakala, completely rout the Pandya forces. They force the entire Pandya royal family to flee their ancestral home and go into exile in Sri Lanka.
It's a devastating blow.
For over a century, the Cholas take over. They install their own viceroys, who take the title Chola Pandyas, to rule from the city of Madurai. The Pandyas go from being regional superpowers to exiled royals living on an island. It reminds me of, like, a sleeper cell. They are just waiting in the shadows for over 100 years, watching the Chola war machine, waiting for the axles to finally rust.
The mechanics of maintaining a royal house in exile for over a century are incredibly complex. You have to keep the bloodline pure, you have to retain the absolute loyalty of your retainers, and you have to convince foreign kings to shelter you.
Which they managed to do.
Brilliantly. They utilized strategic marriages and alliances with the Sinhalese kings of Sri Lanka and with the Cheras back on the mainland in Kerala. They essentially functioned as a constant low-level insurgency, continually probing the Chola borders. They were just waiting for an internal succession crisis or a moment of military overextension by the Chola emperors.
And their patience eventually paid off in the 13th century. The Chola state finally began to fracture, and the Pandyas returned to the mainland to forge their greatest era yet. This is the Second Empire. The catalyst for this return was Maravarman Sundara Pandya. He routed the weakened Chola army, but he didn't just defeat them. He marched on the Chola capital of Thanjavur and sacked the city.
Sacking Thanjavur was not just about looting treasury vaults. I mean, it was an act of profound political theater. Thanjavur was the physical manifestation of Chola supremacy. By capturing it, breaking its walls, and according to some sources, performing rituals of humiliation upon its ruins, Maravarman Sundara Pandya was erasing a century of Pandya disgrace.
He was making a very loud statement.
Yes. He was signaling to every chieftain and governor in the subcontinent that the old order was completely dead, and the Pandyas were the undisputed masters of the Tamil country once again.
But the true zenith of this second empire, you know, their absolute golden age, occurred under a ruler named Jatavarman Sundara Pandyan I. He took the throne in 1251, and looking at the sources, his military campaigns were just relentless.
The historical records often refer to him as the Second Ashoka.
Referring to the ancient Mauryan emperor.
Exactly. Because the sheer geographic scale of his conquest was totally unprecedented for a southern king. He didn't just defeat the Cholas, he completely subjugated their remaining territories, forcing them into vassalage. He marched north into the Deccan and killed the Hoysala king, Samsvara, on the battlefield.
Wow, I mean, that is a massive power shift.
It is. He pushed all the way to the Palva capital of Kanchipuram, claiming it for himself, and extended the empire's borders north to Nellore and deep south into Sri Lanka.
And his successor, Maravarman Kulisakara I, finalized this dominance. He reigned from 1268 to 1308. In 1279, the Cholas and the Hoysalas formed one final desperate coalition to try and break the Pandyas.
And it failed.
Kulisakara crushed them, effectively ending the Chola dynasty forever. He also led another invasion into Sri Lanka, and he didn't just take gold this time. The sources say he captured the sacred tooth relic of the Buddha and brought it back to Madurai. Why take a relic?
The tooth relic is one of the most politically charged objects in South Asian history. In the specific context of Sri Lankan politics, possession of the tooth relic equated directly to the divine right to rule the island.
So it's not just a religious artifact.
No, it was the ultimate palladium of state. By physically removing it from the island and locking it in a vault in Madurai, Kulisakara was not just stealing something holy, he was decapitating the political legitimacy of the Sinhalese kings. He was forcing them to recognize Pandya suzerainty if they ever wanted their sacred relic returned.
Governing a territory that stretched from Nellore all the way down into an island across the sea, that is a massive logistical nightmare. The sources note that Kulisakara utilized a co-regency system called the Five Pandyas to manage the territory. He essentially shared executive and military power with his brothers and sons, stationing them in different regional capitals.
Which works well until it doesn't.
Exactly. But I want to pause and challenge the morality of the expansion we just covered. Under Jatavarman Sundara Pandyan I, the Pandyas completely annihilated the Hoysala kingdom. But if you look back just a few decades in the sources, the Hoysalas were the very people who had provided military aid to the Pandyas to help them survive against the Cholas.
Right, they were allies.
And the Pandyas turned around and slaughtered the people who saved them. That sounds less like heroic statecraft and more like ruthless, backstabbing geopolitical betrayal.
It is entirely ruthless.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to view it through the lens of classical Indian political theory, specifically concepts outlined in texts like the Arthashastra. There is a prevailing geopolitical framework known as the mandala theory.
How does that work?
Imagine a series of concentric circles radiating out from your capital. The theory dictates that your immediate adjacent neighbor is your natural enemy because you are competing for the exact same borderlands and resources.
Okay, that makes sense.
But the neighbor of your neighbor is your natural ally because you share a mutual enemy.
Ah, I see.
So when the Chola Empire was massive and powerful, the Pandyas and the Hoysalas were separated by Chola territory. They were natural allies against the Chola threat. But once the Pandyas shattered the Chola state, the map changed. Suddenly, the Pandyas and the Hoysalas were adjacent regional powers staring at each other across a new, highly contested border.
So the alliance just vanishes.
Under the mandala theory, the alliance instantly dissolves and conflict becomes an absolute structural inevitability. Morality and gratitude do not factor into the preservation of an empire. It was just a calculated necessity to secure total hegemony over the peninsula.
To rule an empire forged by that kind of ruthless expansion requires an incredibly sophisticated administrative system. And what the sources reveal is a fascinating paradox. We are looking at a system that balanced absolute, unquestioned monarchy at the top with a very strict system of local democracy at the bottom.
Let's start at the top. The central state operated entirely on the premise of divine authority. The king was the supreme commander of the armies, the final judicial arbiter, and the ultimate owner of all land.
But he can't manage everything alone.
Exactly. An empire of that scale cannot be micromanaged by one man. The sources detail the existence of two critical advisory bodies at the capital. First, you have the Emperungulu, which is a 5-member council of high-ranking ministers. Then you have the Emperium, an 8-member group of executive officials, military commanders, and treasury attendants.
So what exactly did they do?
These councils handled the high-level macroeconomics, minting the currency, directing the international pearl trade, negotiating with foreign ambassadors, and managing the logistics of the royal army.
But the day-to-day life of the average farmer or artisan was not governed by the king's council. It was governed locally by the sabhas, which were village assemblies. We have highly specific granular details about how these assemblies operated, thanks to the Manur inscription.
Yes, a stone record dated to the year 800.
This inscription outlines the rules for local governance, and they are intensely strict. To even be eligible for a seat on the assembly, a person had to own a specific amount of property and possess a deep, demonstrable knowledge of complex Vedic texts. Furthermore, the inscription explicitly states that anyone found guilty of administrative misconduct or embezzlement was permanently banned from participating in the Sabha ever again.
It is a rigorous system of localized oligarchy. The men sitting on these assemblies were the educated landowning elites of the village.
It sounds exactly like a high-stakes, ruthless, modern homeowners association. You have a council of local property owners dictating the daily rules, managing the neighborhood funds, and instantly expelling anyone who steps out of line.
That is an excellent analogy. Because just like a homeowners association, the Sabhas were responsible for the physical infrastructure that kept the community alive. The central state demanded 1/6 of the agricultural produce as tax to fund the armies. But the state did not build the farms. The local assemblies did.
Right.
Southern India is highly dependent on variable monsoon rains. To survive, you need massive irrigation tanks, known as arangals, to capture and store the rainwater. The Sabhas organized the labor to dredge these tanks. They set up the boundary stones to mark property lines, and they strictly managed the daily distribution of water to the various fields.
And the system actually had a built-in economic safety net. The sources specifically note that if the crops failed due to a lack of monsoon rain or natural water scarcity, the Sabha would report this, and then the affected land would be declared entirely tax-free for that cycle.
Which is incredibly progressive for the time.
Yeah, you have an absolute divinely appointed monarch sitting on a throne in Madurai. But out in the fields, the water rights and the tax exemptions are being calculated by a hyperlocal council of property owners.
The efficiency of that paradox is precisely why the Pandya administrative model lasted for centuries. The central government in Madurai simply did not have the bureaucratic bandwidth or the communication technology to micromanage a village-level dispute over a broken irrigation sluice hundreds of miles away.
It would be impossible.
Right. So by delegating that authority to the local sabhas, the king ensured that the agrarian base remained stable, disputes were resolved quickly, and the infrastructure was maintained. That stability guaranteed a steady, massive flow of grain and tax revenue back to the capital, which freed up the king to focus on war and global trade.
And this highly organized, wealthy society didn't just build armies and irrigation tanks. They built a lasting cultural and architectural legacy that defines the identity of South India to this day. Let's look at the cultural side first. The Sangam Academies. The Pandyas heavily patronized these literary councils in their capital of Madurai.
The word Sangam roughly translates to an assembly or a fraternity. According to tradition, the Pandya kings hosted three successive academies of poets, scholars, and grammarians.
Did all three actually exist?
While the historicity of the very first two is shrouded in myth, the third Sangam produced a vast corpus of literature that fundamentally codified the Tamil language.
They produced works like the Silapatikaram, which is one of the great epics of Tamil literature.
Yes, the Silapatikaram, or the Tale of an Anklet. It is a profound, tragic epic that weaves together themes of justice, fate, and the power of a chaste woman to bring down an unjust king. By funding the scholars who wrote and preserved these texts, the Pandya state positioned itself as the ultimate guardian of Tamil linguistic and cultural identity. It was a soft power projection that made them beloved by their subjects.
But alongside this literary flourishing, there was a massive religious shift over the centuries. As we mentioned, during the Kalabar Dark Age, Jainism and Buddhism had established very strong footholds in the Pandya country. The early kings often favored these traditions. However, the sources show a dramatic pivot. With the rise of the Bhakti movement, rulers like Arikisari Maravarman publicly converted to Shaivism.
It was a very visible conversion.
Yeah, and the sources highlight the profound influence of wandering Shaivite saints, like the famous child Saint Sambandar, in convincing the kings to convert. What exactly is the Bhakti movement, and why did it threaten the established Jain and Buddhist orders?
To understand this shift, you really have to understand the theology. At that time, Jainism and Buddhism were often associated with austere monasticism. They required intense intellectual study, severe asceticism, and detachment from the world. They were also heavily supported by the wealthy urban merchant classes.
So they were seen as a bit elite.
Exactly. The Bhakti movement, which translates to devotion, was a radical departure. It emphasized an intense, deeply personal, and highly emotional connection to a specific deity, most commonly Shiva or Vishnu.
So it's much more accessible.
Hugely accessible. The Bhakti saints composed passionate hymns in the local Tamil vernacular rather than elite Sanskrit or Pali. They danced, they sang, and they preached that salvation was available to anyone, regardless of caste or education, simply through pure love for the god. It was a massive populist groundswell.
This makes me wonder about the motivation of the kings. When a king like Arikisari Maravarman shifted from Jainism to Shaivism, was it a genuine spiritual awakening sparked by hearing the hymns of Sambandar? Or was it just a highly calculated political move to align himself with this rising populist movement and unify the masses under his rule?
In the ancient world, the line between personal piety and political utility is almost non-existent. The Bhakti movement was capturing the hearts of the agrarian masses. The Jain and Buddhist institutions were increasingly viewed as aloof, foreign, and associated with the displaced Kalabra rulers.
So it was just smart politics.
Absolutely. By publicly converting to Shaivism, the Pandya king was aligning the monarchy with the emotional core of his subjects.
And they cemented that alignment in stone. This religious shift heavily influenced their architectural output. The Pandyas took the early forms of Dravidian temple architecture and evolved them to new monumental heights.
We should probably define what Dravidian architecture actually looks like.
Please do.
It is characterized by the Vimana, which is the pyramid-like tower over the inner sanctum, and crucially, the Gopuram, which is the massive, highly ornate gateway tower at the entrance of the temple complex. The Pandyas laid the foundational groundwork and the early structures for the world-famous Meenakshi Amman temple complex right in the center of Madurai.
They also experimented with rock-cut architecture, right? Carving entirely out of the bedrock.
Yes, the most stunning example is the Vetuvan Koil. This is a monolithic temple, meaning it is not built from separate blocks of stone. It is carved downward, completely excavated out of a single solid hill of granite.
That is just incredible to picture.
The intricate carvings on the Vetuvan Koil show heavy stylistic influences from the Pallava and Chalukya traditions further north. This proves that Pandya architects were absorbing and adapting pan-Indian artistic techniques.
But these temples were not just places of worship, were they?
No, they were the economic engines of the state. As the kings patronized Shaivism, they gifted vast tracts of tax-free land to these temples. The temples became the largest employers, the largest landowners, and essentially the central banks of the region. So, returning to our earlier question about the king's motivation, converting to Shaivism and building these complexes allowed the state to deeply integrate the monarchy into a religious system that controlled the local economy.
That golden age, the vast territories, the towering gopurams, the wealth pouring in from the pearl trade, it all comes to a crashing, violent halt in the early 14th century.
The fall of this 2,000-year-old empire was brought down by a toxic combination of internal betrayal and a geographic stroke of incredibly bad luck. The catalyst was a predictable flaw in their system, a succession crisis. In 1308, the great king Mayurvarman Kulasekara I died. The co-regency system, the five Pandyas model that had allowed them to govern such a vast territory, completely fractured. A brutal, uncompromising civil war erupted immediately between his two sons, Sundara Pandyan and Veera Pandyan.
So they are exhausting their own armies, burning their own fields, just fighting for the throne. And while they are distracted by fratricide, a massive, unprecedented threat appears from the north. In 1311, the Sultan of Delhi, Alauddin Khilji, dispatches his most prominent and feared general, Malik Kafur, on a deep penetration expedition into the south. Why is the Delhi Sultanate marching an army thousands of miles away from their capital?
We have to be clear about Malik Kafur's objective. The sources explicitly note that this was not a war of territorial annexation. The Delhi Sultanate had no interest in trying to permanently administer the deep south. This was a highly targeted treasure-hunting expedition.
They were just there for the money.
Completely. The Sultanate knew that the southern kingdoms, specifically the Pandyas, had spent centuries accumulating vast reserves of Roman gold, precious gems, and war elephants, locking them away in their temple vaults. Kafur was sent to extract that capital to fund the Sultanate's own wars in the north.
The divided Pandya forces were entirely unprepared for the military tactics and the scale of the Delhi Sultanate's army. When Kafur's forces approached the Tamil country, the two warring brothers actually disagreed on how to respond.
They couldn't even unite against a common enemy.
No. Veera Pandyan, who seems to have understood the tactical mismatch, advocated for a defensive strategy. He wanted to pull their forces back and hold the heavily fortified walls of Madurai. But Sundara Pandyan was impatient. He wanted a decisive, glorious victory to legitimize his claim to the throne. So he gathered his forces, his infantry, and his cavalry, and marched out to meet Kafur's army in open combat.
Which was exactly what Kafur wanted.
Right. And this brings us back to the moment we opened the show with. Geography sealed their fate. It was the peak of the hot summer in 1311. Sundara Pandyan led his troops along the route of the Kaveri River, entirely relying on it to provide water for thousands of men and horses. But the monsoon had failed. The river was completely dry.
And the logistics of ancient warfare dictate that marching an army without a secure supply of water is a fatal error. By the time Sundara's forces actually encountered Malik Kafur's vanguard, the Pandya infantry and cavalry were already suffering from severe dehydration, heat exhaustion, and collapsing morale.
And when they finally engaged, it was a slaughter.
It was a complete tactical mismatch. The Pandya cavalry heavily relied on traditional lighter armor and close-quarter swordsmanship. They were fighting an enemy they had never seen before. Kafur's forces utilized heavily armored cavalry, and more importantly, they deployed mounted archers known as Turkapols.
So they could shoot on the move.
Exactly. They could shoot and ride away.
Yeah.
Plus, they had highly disciplined ranks of crossbowmen. The exhausted, thirsty Pandya army simply could not close the distance. They were systematically decimated by ranged attacks under the sweltering sun. Sundara Pandyan's field army collapsed, and he was taken captive on the battlefield.
Sundara basically handed the empire to Malik Kafur by marching his men into a dry riverbed. It is staggering to think about. This dynasty survived the Kalabras, they survived a century of exile under the Cholas, they built the greatest maritime trade network in the ancient world, but they weren't ultimately beaten by superior, inescapable military genius. They were beaten by a catastrophic, impatient, unforced error.
And once Sundara's field army was destroyed, Kafur faced almost no resistance in advancing directly to the capital. He laid siege to Madurai, where the other brother, Veera Pandyan, was desperately holding out behind the walls.
The siege lasted for weeks. The sources indicate Veerapandiyan actually managed to hold the walls for a significant time because Kafur's army lacked heavy, specialized siege weapons like trebuchets. They had to rely on inferior battering rams. The Pandya defenders continuously harassed the Sultanate camps with night raids and archery from the ramparts.
But a siege is ultimately a game of mathematics, and the Pandyas were running out of food.
Right. Finally, the stalemate resulted in a negotiation.
And the terms of that negotiation are what effectively ended the Pandya Empire. Malik Kafur agreed to lift the siege, but the ransom he extracted completely stripped the state of its military and economic power. He left Madurai with an astonishing haul.
It's almost hard to believe the numbers.
We are talking about 96,000 gold coins, massive chests of precious stones, half of all the rice that had been rationed inside the city walls, and crucially, all of the Pandya's war elephants and their imported cavalry horses.
He took the exact assets they needed to maintain power. Without their wealth to pay the armies, without their elephants to break formations, and without their imported Arabian horses, the empire could no longer project authority.
They were crippled.
The central apparatus in Madurai fractured. Over the following decades, the massive territory split apart into independent Islamic sultanates and regional Nayak governors. The once mighty Pandyas, the lords of the two seas, faded into mere vassals. They held on to tiny, insignificant pockets of territory before disappearing from the historical record entirely in the 17th century.
The speed of the collapse is staggering. But paradoxically, the sheer volume of wealth that Kafur extracted is the ultimate testament to the success of the Pandya system. It proves just how much capital they had accumulated over centuries of dominating the pearl trade, organizing the agricultural sapas, and ruthlessly executing the mandala theory against their neighbors.
The Pandyas built a legacy that spanned nearly two millennia. They weaponized the symbol of the charging bull and the myth of the moon. They funded armies with the pearls of the ocean and codified an entire culture through the poetry of the Sangam academies. They left us the towering gopurams of the Madurai temples and a brilliant blueprint for balancing absolute royal authority with localized, village-level administration.
It is a remarkable run.
It is. But examining their history leaves you with a haunting hypothetical to consider. What if Malik Kafur had arrived just one decade earlier when the Pandya brothers were united under the strong central rule of Kulasekara? Or what if the monsoon had arrived just a few weeks early and the Kaveri River hadn't run dry in the sweltering summer of 1311? Would the longest ruling dynasty in Indian history have survived the medieval period to shape the modern era rather than fading into a vassal state, leaving behind only the echo of the charging bull?
It makes you wonder.
Thank you for listening. History Maps. Learn history visually.